Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could listen. During this hour, Focus 580, let's talk about jazz. We don't do that enough on this show. This community is blessed with a long history of jazz performances and musicianship, and we don't pay enough attention to it. The Krannert Center for the Performing Arts is now organizing a season-long community engagement project exploring jazz called Jazz Threads, providing a number of opportunities for listeners, musicians, children, everyone to experience, enjoy, and learn about jazz. During this hour, we'll talk about that and have a dialogue about what jazz is all about. Our guest is one of the hardest-working jazz musicians on the New York City scene, Cecil Bridgewater. Cecil Bridgewater was born and raised in Champaign, Urbana, and is a graduate of the University of Illinois. He is, in fact, a third-generation jazz musician from the Bridgewater family around here. He has performed and recorded with the likes of Max Roach, Horace Silver, Dizzy Gillespie, McCoy Tyner, the Count Basie Orchestra, the Duke Ellington Orchestra, and the Thad Jones Mel Lewis Orchestra. Not a bad jazz resume. He's also produced recordings for other artists and has CDs of his own compositions and recordings. He's a faculty member of the New School for Social Research and also dedicates time to spreading the gospel of jazz through ArtReach and Dr. Billy Taylor's Jazz Mobile programs. And that's his trumpet playing in the background, by the way. Cecil Bridgewater will be in Champaign-Urbana the week after next for a week of events in the Jazz Threads project, including a performance with his band at the Krannert Center on September 27th. He'll also be giving a series of clinics and master classes in the Champaign schools, Parkland College, and the University of Illinois. And on September 23rd at noon, he'll present at the University YMCA Know Your University lecture. And later that evening, he'll be part of a jazz jam at Champaign's Two Main Lounge, starting at 9 o'clock. And we'll have a bit of a jazz jam with Cecil Bridgewater starting right here during this hour of Focus. As we talk with Cecil Bridgewater, we're going to play some music, and we're going to invite your calls. If you have questions or comments on the subject of jazz, you can join us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest or anywhere in the U.S. if you're listening on the web, 800-222-9455. Anytime, feel free to join our conversation. And meanwhile, let's say hello to Cecil Bridgewater, who joins us by telephone this morning from New York. Mr. Bridgewater, hello.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing fine. Glad to be there.
Well, we're very happy to have you. And we're going to have, actually, I think, the first of 3 week-long visits you're making to Champaign-Urbana coming
up. That's correct.
Yeah. You're going to be the hardest-working man in Champaign-Urbana.
Yeah, I just heard you read off all of those things I'm going to be doing, so it does look like I'm going to be busy.
Made me tired just listing them all.
Yes. Well, I'm looking forward to it. It's an opportunity to share some of the information that I've gathered over the years with a lot of the community and young musicians, and, you know, that's always a joy for me.
Right. Well, I hope during this hour we can talk about a lot of things. One thing I would like to do, if it's okay with you, is play some music and then talk about it.
Okay.
And one of the things that I want to try to get at is the diversity that exists within jazz.
Mm-hmm.
What maybe, you know, people don't, you know, people think of jazz as in one way and, maybe haven't been exposed to a variety of different kinds of music.
Sure. That's true.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about how people understand jazz. Some people love jazz right away.
Mm-hmm.
Other people sometimes learn to love it, and maybe some people never do for whatever reason.
Well, and a lot of that, I think, has to do with the exposure.
Uh-huh.
For myself, my brother, and my sister, we got exposed through our parents very early on. When I was about 10 years old, excuse me, my father took me to a concert at Huff Gym. And I remember sitting in the what seemed like the rafters,
mm-hmm.
and looking down, and this band came out and started to play, and I got excited about that. And then this trumpet player came out, and he started to play, and then I think that's when I decided that's what I wanted to do. I didn't know what they were doing, you know, I didn't know what the music was called or anything, but it was exciting to me, and that was something I was interested in. I'd heard my father pick up the trumpet, you know, around the house,
mm-hmm.
and play it some, and he would let me blow on it a little bit, but when I heard this gentleman come out and play, well, it turned out it was Louis Armstrong.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of years later, Dad took me to another concert at Huff Gym, Then it was a big band, and so I got excited all over again, and turned out it was the Duke Ellington Orchestra.
Yeah.
So, you know, exposure for us as children was a big key, because that exposed us to some things that we might not have, you know, heard ordinarily. And I think that's one of the big things, that's one of the things that I enjoy being involved with now, is exposing young children. I mean, I just played something here in New York for preschoolers, and to see them get excited about listening to the music and just being involved in it was, you know, was always a big joy. And if you catch them at that age, then, you know, from the rest of their lives, they can appreciate to whatever degree they want that type of music.
I certainly understand what you're saying. My own daughter, who, when she was four, heard Louis Armstrong, and who you just mentioned, and she was immediately, "Oh wow, I really like this. This is this is what is this music called?" And we told her, "This is jazz, Jessica. This is jazz." And she said, "I like jazz."
Well, I think that's a big part of it, because, and sometimes later on, they get children get involved with others. Kids and peer pressure and so forth, and you don't want to like that stuff.
Sure.
You know, whatever it might be. It might be music, it might be, you know, anything else. But I think at an early age, they're wide open to whatever, you know, their fancy takes them. So I think that's an important aspect of it, too. Because sometimes, you know, later on we get inhibitions about liking or disliking certain things, or, you know. But I think as children, we're wide open to that. So that's why exposure for me was very important early on.
I sometimes think jazz can be intimidating for people who think they don't, or, and maybe they can't understand it.
Well, yeah, you know, and that's some of the quote-unquote phobias that I think people develop. It's just music, you know. It's like any other kind of music, you know. And that's one of the problems that I have with quote-unquote categories. People want to put music in certain kinds of categories, but the last word in there is music, and that appeals, you know, that should appeal to everybody, whether it's Indian music or Japanese music or African music or wherever it comes from. The main thing is that it has so many emotional, you know, you get something emotionally from it, and no matter what kind of music it is. So if you feel something about the music, then it's probably okay.
Yeah.
And so, you know, then take all the other stigmas away from it as to how difficult it is. I mean, if that was the case, then we wouldn't be able to understand the European composers and, you know, all the other kinds of quote-unquote categories that we put music in. Jazz is no more difficult or no more strange than anything else.
Yeah. You mentioned growing up hearing Louis Armstrong and I think Duke Ellington Orchestra, in Huff Hall. And maybe people who have been here a long time know this, and maybe people passing through going to the University of Illinois and maybe not even connected with, you know, especially those not connected with the music program, aren't aware of the deep roots of music in Champaign Urbana, in Champaign County.
Sure. Well, like I said, growing up in the community, I found a number of musicians who were living in Champaign for whatever reason. One, of course, was Jack McDuff, who was from Champaign also, great organist, who was a bass player before that. And he brought a group of musicians to Champaign who were living in Chicago at the time. And some of them stayed. One was a gentleman we called by his stage name, Count Demon, who was a great drummer and entertainer. Tony Zamora, saxophonist, who came to live in Champaign-Urbana, along with Norman Langford, who was also from the area, the Heights. My uncle Pete were all instrumental in being involved in music within the community. And then, of course, on the campus, John Garvey, just I think a couple of years before I started at U of I, had started to institute a jazz program of some sort there. It wasn't part of the school. It was, you know, an adjunct to the school. But he was bringing in people like J.J. Johnson and the Modern Jazz Quartet, Eric Dolphy, and various people, you know, to perform at the university and also to perform with the bands that we had there. And a number of good musicians who came in, you know, to the school. because they found out there was a good program there. And so that helped nurture a lot of musicians from the campus and from, you know, all around the country. And then there, right across the street from our house on Washington was a club that was the AMVETS, the American Veterans uh-huh. Club. And they used to have music on there on the weekends and Mondays. And so my brother and I used to listen, you know, to the music coming across from the club. We didn't know necessarily what we were listening to at the time. It was just exciting, and we enjoyed it. I don't think all the people in the neighborhood necessarily enjoyed it because, people would come out of the club and be a little noisy at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, so that wasn't
right.
necessarily the most pleasant thing for some of the other people. But for Ron and I, it was exciting, and we'd, you know, lay up in the window and listen until we fell asleep. So it was, you know, a great experience for us to get a chance to hear live music, even though we couldn't go into a place where they were selling alcohol or anything at that age. You know, we were like kids at that time.
We're talking this morning with Cecil Bridgewater. He's a jazz musician, composer, and performer living in New York City. He's from Champaign-Urbana, and he'll be visiting here for a week in the Cranert Jazz Thread series, engaging in a number of activities. And we have a caller to talk with. We're going to continue our conversation with Cecil Bridgewater, play some more music, and also welcome your calls. The number again around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Champaign County on line number one. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm sort of peripheral to the jazz scene here. I'm a fan, and I'm a fairly big enthusiast. And I have to mention that I went to the Chicago Jazz Festival to the Sunday night finale, which some people here said was the weakest of the events. And it was an amazing show. All four acts, including the finale, which was the McCoy Tyner Big Band with 11 horns. It was just awesome. I guess he was there for the inaugural jazz festival 25 years ago, so there's a long legacy there. But that's just sort of an aside, and I'm still high on the event, I guess. What I wanted to ask specifically was about your father's legacy. And As I say, I'm not plugged in, but I think there was some discussion at the Jazz Threads group and some other groups here that your father has a garage full of old tapes of interviews and maybe performances, too. And is anybody taking care of those? It'd be nice if, when you're here, somebody would pony up the resources. And I'll hang up and listen because I got a noisy line here.
Okay.
Maritech's not doing me very good today.
Okay, thanks for the question.
Yeah, that's my uncle Pete, who was a disc jockey for many, many years. He just passed away back in June or July, I think it was. He has a number of interviews, and he has CDs, 78s, 33 and a thirds, you know, all the tape and everything of interviews and recordings that he's used on his show many times. And so he, all of that stuff is at the home. And I think his children are trying to decide how they want to, you know, put that all together. I think it should be all archived somewhere. And my mother's been instrumental in talking with them about that also.
Mm-hmm.
He mentioned interviews with Duke Ellington and a number of other artists that had visited Champaign on occasion, either to do concerts or, you know, Duke used to come sometimes and he would play for dances. And a portion of the performance would be a concert. But, I mean, I remember he used to come to the various places, you know, in the city, as I mentioned, at Huff Gym, but also to play dances sometimes. But a lot of that stuff is Pete's, his children are trying to decide what to do with how to archive all of that stuff. Maybe put it all on CDs and hopefully, you know, make it available to everybody for research, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Your Uncle Pete had a radio show on WDWS for some time.
For years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and sometimes I would come home and he'd, interview me on the show. And one time I came home and he played a recording. It was the very first recording I ever made in Champaign. And I had completely forgotten about it. And he sprung that on me. He used to do things like that.
About that.
But, he had a number of, you know, he was there for a number of years and built up quite an archive of recordings and interviews and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully we'll get a chance to to delve into that at some point and, you know, have that available to, especially to the music school or to the community, you know, anybody who's interested in possibly doing research and things like that.
That would be very worthwhile.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We have another call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. Another Champagne listener on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning.
Yes.
I just wanted to say that I know your mom. I work with her on a volunteer basis, and she's one of the most wonderful people I've ever met. And she speaks so wonderfully of all of her children, but she never brags excessively. She just says, oh, they're very successful musicians. So I think your mother's a wonderful person.
Mm-hmm. I do, too.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks for the call. Mm-hmm. We set out to play some music, and I'd like to do that. And if it's okay with you, I'd like to play a cut off of your CD, Mean What You Say, a wonderful track called Louisiana Strut. And would that be an acceptable choice?
Yeah, that's fine. That came about from a trip that the University of Illinois Jazz Band made to New Orleans.
Uh-huh.
And we were part of the Jazz and Heritage Festival in 1969, I think we went down there. We ended up playing Benny Carter, who just passed away, his arrangements behind Sarah Vaughan. Mm-hmm. But just the experience of being there and having an opportunity to you know, taste the food and so to speak, taste the city, gave me an idea of a composition, and so this is what it turned out to be.
Okay, and I believe this features a lot of the people who are going to be playing with you coming
up. That's right.
Yeah.
So. Kenny Davis on bass, Mulgrew Miller on piano, my brother on saxophone, and the drummer on this one is Billy Hart, but Carl Allen will be the drummer with us. He's played with us on a number of occasions.
Okay, well, this is a 7-minute track, so if it's okay, we won't play the whole thing, but I certainly want to play a good portion of it to give people a sense of the music. So
that's fine.
This is Louisiana Strut. Okay, that's a track called Louisiana Strut off of Cecil Bridgewater's disc, Mean What You Say, and very nice.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
It's always a little difficult for me to listen to me. Because I always know, oh, I could have done that better. This could have been, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody else always sounds great, but I always sound like, eh.
Of course.
That's just the way it is, I guess.
Right. Now, you play trumpet and flugelhorn.
Yes.
I guess I'm curious as to how you decide what to play on what.
Usually it depends on the type of piece. If it's something like maybe a bossa nova or a ballad or something,
yeah.
I'm more apt to play flugelhorn. If it's something that needs a little more power, then it's probably going to be on trumpet.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I love playing the flugelhorn. I love playing both of them, but yeah. The flugelhorn has a rounder, kind of fatter sound, and it lends itself to certain kinds of tunes, for me at least.
Yeah, so it depends on what you want to sound like.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. Another listener in Urbana next on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I'm so excited you're coming. I have so many questions that I've got to ask. One, like when you wrote that last tune, the harmonies in the horns, how do you do that? Or to what extent is it? First of all, what are those intervals? And then coming back to intervals, do you think... What about intervals? Like if you were going to play two intervals that would make a listener, you know, a kid or somebody like me, okay, I hear that, just the technique in that last tune, what would they be? And that's enough. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks.
Well, it's almost like the same question with about the flugelhorn. It depends on what the piece seems to call for, because I try to envision every piece being something unto itself or to exemplify a certain thing. Sometimes Ron and I are playing the same notes. Sometimes we're playing in what we would call thirds, depending on, you know, the composition and the, you know, what the intent of what I'm trying to portray in that. A lot of what I've learned started at Champaign High School, trying to write for a small group that we had. It was Darnell Banks was playing saxophone. On occasion, Maurice McKinley would play drums with us. And so we would, you know, I was trying to learn from listening to other people and deciding on, you know, what made that sound that way. And over the years, of course, having been in bands with people like Horace Silver, who... great composer and arranger. I learned a lot from him, also from Thad Jones, you know, being in Thad Jones' Mel Lewis Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And just listening and learning and trying things and seeing what works is always, you know, it's always kind of a trial and error. And if it works, then you keep it. If it doesn't work, then you set it aside and see if it works someplace else.
One of the interesting things to me about jazz harmony has always been the sort of extension of voicings and using a lot of sort of altered voicings, maybe instead of playing the root and the bass, playing something completely unexpected, perhaps, you know, in terms of, you know.
Well, that's part of what the beauty of this music is, you know, and why it attracted me so. I mean, when I was growing up, I studied with a trumpet teacher who was at the University of Illinois, Haskell Sexton, and he was taking me through all the classical literature and so forth. He said he didn't know much about jazz and wasn't going to try to teach me that. He realized I had an interest in it, but he said he was going to teach me how to practice. And so he would give me practice techniques in order to accomplish whatever it was I wanted to accomplish. And from that, I could go on and do whatever I wanted to do. But with jazz, there was an immediate opportunity to be a composer and make a contribution to the music instead of, you know, having to play Beethoven and Bach and Brahms and so forth and so on, just playing the notes that were written and interpreted by the conductor. Then I began to realize that these people were also great improvisers. You know, if there was a cadenza on a piece, that was the place in particular that the composer had an opportunity to improvise. So I used to get in a little bit of trouble at the University of Illinois because I would ask them why they didn't teach us to improvise in the style of Bach, Beethoven, or Brahms or somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that wasn't part of the curriculum. It wasn't part of what was supposed to happen. So jazz was my outlet for doing that. It was an opportunity to change my solo every time I played it, so that, you know, that was the exciting part for me. That was the opportunity to make a big contribution. And that's carried me through, you know, ever since.
We're a little past our midpoint here. We're talking with Cecil Bridgewater, jazz musician, composer, performer, living in New York City right now. He's from Champaign-Urbana. We'll be returning here as part of the Kraner Center Jazz Thread Series, actually the first week of three that he'll be doing, coming back, doing a number of clinics and events, talking with people, jam sessions, and a whole bunch of activities. And we're also inviting you to partake in this conversation if you'd like to join us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. One of the most astonishing performances I ever saw was a solo piano performance by Billy Taylor in Chicago a few years ago. And it was actually at a public radio conference. All the public radio people gather, at least those who can afford to, every once in a while, every year to talk about what we're doing. And this was on the event as a sort of an entertainment thing, but also educational, because it was an opportunity to interact with Billy Taylor. Mm-hmm. He played, I don't know what it was, honestly. It was the most astonishing improvisation, consisting of a sort of a loose structure that he was improvising on, mm-hmm. and just completely blew everybody's minds. And it was just, and then he got up and said, "Okay, does anybody have any questions?" And everybody, their jaws were just still kind of hanging down, and nobody said anything. And he kind of said, "Okay, I'll just keep playing then."
Yeah, he has, he has command of many, many different styles, going back to the stride piano style, and right on up through a lot of things he does today. He has one piece that he plays just completely with the left hand.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, a couple of years ago he had a mild stroke, and so that slowed him down a little bit, but only temporarily. He's back up and running again.
That's great.
But, and he has his hands in a lot of different kinds of things. You mentioned Jazzmobile, which is a thing that he started here in New York. It started out, I think back in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
I got involved in 70, 71, teaching in the workshops, and also doing, in the summertime, they go around to each of the boroughs in New York and do a series of concerts. So in the winter months, they go into the schools and do some teaching and so forth. But he has, that kind of command of the instrument and knowledge of the music and the history of the music. So that's, he provides a very important reference, living reference for this music.
We have a couple callers waiting. Let's include them in our conversation. Another Urbana listener next on line number one. Good morning.
I was just, one time I was writing an article, and there was a man in this community named Roy Williams. I was working on some history, and I said, "Okay, tell me the history of this, and he said, "Well, yeah, right, and then you'll go get a PhD, and nothing will happen. That has anything to do with that history. Just listening to you, Haskell Sexton, and, whole big pieces of things. I didn't know that McDuff was a bass player before that and all that stuff. I just wonder if I'm going to make your mother mad because she's so gracious, but do you have any anger about disseminating this music and then, people jump up and, "Hey, wow, I know this and I know that," and then the true legacy, the true improvising of it, the assaults that came upon it that made it, some of the screams and some of the lyricism even more beautiful, gets sort of down the bourgeois tubes or whatever. Thanks. I'll get off. And I don't mean to be confrontational, but I know you'll make this beautiful. So thank you.
All right.
Well, the history of this music has always been, or early on especially, had been an oral history. It was a tradition that comes from African traditions where things are passed on orally from one generation to the next. In Africa, they have what they call the griot, who was the storyteller who knew all the information about what went on in his community, and he disseminated that onto, you know, to the rest of the, especially the young people coming up, so that they would know it. There's a gentleman, student who's at one of the schools I teach at here in New York, who's who knows, I think it's something like 15 to 20 generations of his family going way back. Mm. He's I think he's from Nigeria, trumpet player. And that's just something he's been taught over the years. A lot of times in today's society, you know, the tendency is to discard our history. Is, you know, it's like something that happened in the 90s for kids now coming into college. Whatever happened in the 90s is now back in the day for them, they call it. Back in the day, you know. The 90s is not even back in the day for me. That's just like yesterday.
Right.
But a lot of the traditions and are discarded in this country more so than other places. I've gone to Europe many years ago. First couple of times I went to Europe, and people would come up to me with albums that I had been on, or they would talk to me about recordings that I had done and different kinds of things, because they have maybe much more of a sense of history, and Japan is like that also. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the United States, primarily, we're interested in the latest and the newest and the fastest and the whatever. And we don't really pay that great attention to what we're building on. That's one of the things I try to impress on students, is that they're standing on the shoulders of all of these great musicians who came before them. And for that reason, they have to know about these people. And they have to study them, and they have to understand, you know, what it is that they went through that is now allowing them to do what it is they do. And if we gloss over that or pass that by, I think we lose a lot. So just my own personal history, my father played trumpet, although not professionally. You know, he played while he was in the Navy and in high school. Before that, he grew up in Tuscola, Illinois, as did my Uncle Pete. Then their father was a professional musician, trumpet player, so I'm at least the third generation. He played the circuses, traveled all around the country three quarters of the year. Winter months he was at home. He was also in the earthquake out in San Francisco in 1906. And I put his name in on the internet one time, and I found that he was one of the lesser known cornet soloists of his time. My mother played piano and sang. She still does, and with church choir and so forth. My mother and father also played in her father's dance band called Max Scott and the Foot Warmers. Grandpa played saxophone, played drums, wrote music, sang as well. And, you know, so there's a little bit of a history that comes down to us as musicians, having grown up in the Champaign-Urbana area. I was actually born in what used to be Mercy Hospital. I think they call it Bravenia now. Yeah. And ended up growing up like about two blocks from there on Washington Street in Champaign. So really a product of, you know, the community and of course, my parents and the exposure that they gave us to the music. My cousin, Landell, who lived right next door to my grandmother, he had an extensive record collection also, and he was an audiophile, so he would play anything I wanted him to play, but I could not jump around or move around in the room for fear that, you know, I might scratch the record. So, but he would play just about anything I wanted to when I'd go by to visit him.
We have a couple other people waiting to talk with us. Mm-hmm. Let's go next to a listener in Champaign on line number two. Good morning, you're on Focus 580.
Hello?
Yes.
I'm enjoying the conversation. I had a question about counterpoint in jazz. There's a song I really love by Nina Simone on, I think, the Verve label, and it's a version of Little Girl Blue with counterpoint to Good King Wenceslas. And I wondered if counterpoint sort of having two melodies going at the same time is something that's common in jazz or in your music, if that's something that you use at all.
Yeah, it's something I think it's continuously used. You know, one of the things about quote-unquote jazz is that it borrows from everything and everybody, just about. People like Duke Ellington wrote compositions, many that are not that well known, Liberian Suite and so forth, that utilize some of the African rhythms and things that he heard. He had another suite called the Eurasian Suite from travels that he made throughout Asia and Europe. And, you know, rhythms like bossa nova, sambas, all of those things that have come from other countries are utilized in this music quite a bit, as well as some of the classical, European classical elements of harmony and counterpoint and so forth. So, it's a compositional vehicle. Improvisation is instant composition. And many times, things happen for the first time and sometimes the only time they ever happen in a performance. That's why it's always good to hear the music live when you can, which is another thing I stress to students. Hearing it on record is one thing, and that's always going to be the same way on a record or CD. Mm-hmm. But when you go to hear somebody live, it's going to be different each time because they can't reproduce exactly what they did before. Now, the pianist, Sir Roland Hanna, who passed away just a little over a year ago, we did some duet concerts, and I first encountered him with Thad Jones and Mel Lewis playing with him. And we did a number of quintet gigs and things together. And I remember once saying that, announcing to the audience that Roland was we throw the term genius around loosely, but I said Roland is truly a genius because he never repeats himself. So he leaned over to me and said, "That's because I can't remember what I did last time." So, but he was a very accomplished, he would sit and play these rhapsodic long pieces that were totally improvised, and some of them sounded like, a Bach prelude or something, and other pieces, he utilized all kinds of elements in his performances, and I think we all tried to do that.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Sure.
We only have about 12 minutes left. I want to play some more music, and then we have another caller. I hope I won't mind. Mm-hmm. That person won't mind me making them wait. But to sort of spread out the spectrum here, I wanted to play something by Miles Davis.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe talk about, we talked about the variety of jazz borrowing from anything, essentially. Mm-hmm. This is way different. This is something from the Bitches Brew disc,
mm-hmm.
A track called Spanish Key. And this features actually three people playing piano, Joe Zawinul, Larry Young, and Chick Corea.
Mm-hmm.
I know you know the disc.
Mm-hmm.
Wayne Shorter on soprano sax, Lenny White on drums, and a whole bunch of really great musicians. So let's play a little bit of this cut just to sort of get a sense, and then we'll talk some more. Thank you. All right, this is Miles Davis from the disc Bitches Brew, which it certainly was something that hit me pretty hard when it came out. That's a track called Spanish Key. And, you know, the thing about that that strikes me is there's a lot, first of all, there's a lot going on. The second thing is there's the tonic that the bass is kind of just, you know, vamping on. But there's a lot of tension going on around that tonic and sort of an implication that it's shifting when, in fact, it rarely did. I think it does maybe once or twice, but essentially it stays in the same key. But there's a lot of stuff going on that's way outside that.
Well, actually, that album, or that particular cut anyway, is not that much different from what he did about 20 years before that.
Uh-huh.
On, what's the name of the album? With all blues on it, and some of the things he did with Bill Evans on piano.
Uh-huh.
Can't think of the name of the album, just slipped my mind. That he did in the late 50s. This album was kind of different because he was using a lot of electronic instruments, although he had, just previously to that, on Columbia, Herbie Hancock played Fender Rhodes, and so did Chick Corea with him at that point. But this was more of like layering sound. It wasn't just one particular sound that he was working from. When he did So What and those things, it was like a modal scale that he just played from. Actually, if you listen closely, Miles doesn't play much differently than he always did.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the surroundings, the things that he put around him sometimes that were different. So he was very consistent. He was also very forward-looking. He's always looking for different sounds, different things to put together, and different ways of presenting himself and presenting the music in a special light. And there were a lot of people who, when this album came out, did not like it at all, and kind of reviled against it. But Miles was always, you know, 2-3 steps ahead of everybody else and what he was trying to accomplish and what he was trying to do. And so that just became part of who he was.
One of the things about Miles Davis that always struck me is he could really say a lot with very few notes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he made that's one of the things that it's hard to get across to students now, is to get them to understand, just get to the point, you know, leave off all the other verbiage that we don't necessarily need, and just get to the point, you know, get to what it is you want to say. And I think that's the mark of a great orator, is to be able to do that. It takes a lot of editing on your part, instant editing, because as you're performing, you have to edit what you're saying and what you're doing. And, you know, but again, Miles had the opportunity to perform ongoingly, you know, with his bands. And so he had an opportunity to develop that kind of way of playing. When he was with Charlie Parker played a lot. Miles didn't have to play as much, you know, as many notes. When he was with John Coltrane, it was the same kind of thing. So he developed, I guess, maybe the first minimalist in jazz, so to speak, by the style and, you know, that he developed over the years.
We have another call to talk with in just about maybe 4 minutes left, so let's include them. They've been waiting patiently, and this is a listener in Normal on line number 4. Good morning.
Hi, I was wanted to talk about mode. You just mentioned that, the modal scale. I've never fully understood modal playing. And could you give a brief explanation of playing modes? And am I correct in assuming that a lot of jazz soloing is a mode based on the fifth tone?
Well, it kind of depends. I mean, like the earlier Louis Armstrong guys came along in that period from New Orleans or from wherever in the country. They tended to play more the arpeggiated kind of playing, which means ba-do-de-do-da-do-do-de-do-do-do, that kind of playing. And that was, you know, that was coming from the march music that was influential at that time. By the time we get to end of the 40s and the so-called bebop era with Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, J.J. Johnson, people like that, Thelonious Monk, they started to play more scale-wise and introduced different kinds of notes. By the time Miles kind of introduced the modal concept, it was about Well, and John Coltrane is a good example. John Coltrane had a composition called Giant Steps, where he had the piano and the bass player moving to every combination of sounds that he was playing on the horn. And then once he got introduced to modal playing, he would have the rhythm section play one, you know, play like a drone, like an Indian drone or something, and then he would improvise all of these other things on top of that. So it doesn't just stay in one key for the improviser. Often it moves around. But for the rhythm section, the piano, bass, drums, sometimes they're, you know, kind of used in a sort of way to create that that one scale sound. And then the piano player, of course, is allowed to superimpose other sounds on top of that. But it becomes a situation, and for an improviser, it's actually more difficult because you got to be much more imaginative when you start to perform in that style, because it could get extremely boring if you're just playing the same notes over and over and over. Whereas with different kinds of music where you have the chord changes moving a lot, it creates its own variety, and then the improviser, you know, can improvise over that. So it's but it all breaks down to storytelling, being able to tell the story well, no matter what style you're playing in, so that you know, it becomes a thing where you get the point across, you get to the point, and you tell the story.
Thank you.
All right, thanks very much for the call. We're at the point where we're going to have to stop. I want to take at least a minute of the time remaining, though, to mention a couple events coming up, the first of which is, well, actually not the first of which, but perhaps the marquee event is your concert at the Krannert Center, Tryon Festival Theater, Saturday, September 27th at 7:30 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have your band with you then.
Yes.
And that should be great.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, and a whole bunch of events, and I take it you're going to be talking to a whole lot of people while you're in town.
Well, that's what it seems, yes. And it's interesting because growing up, I was extremely, extremely shy, and I wouldn't talk to anybody. But, you know, over the years, I've become more comfortable with this subject in particular and other subjects that I've, you know, gotten a chance to delve into. And by teaching, of course, you know, standing up in front of a class and having to orate some. And actually realize that people are listening, so, you know, then you become a little better at it. But it's about storytelling again, you know. But the performance level for me, I mean, even in high school when I was extremely shy, I could always get up in front of people and play the trumpet. I would get a little nervous, but it was, you know, as long as I had the trumpet in my hands, I was okay. Walking down the street to talk to somebody might be more difficult for me at that point. But I've gotten more comfortable with all that now.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to stop. Let me just, for a moment, pretend we have high production values on the show, typically. And we're going to play one final track as we take it out. This is a John Scofield track called Groovelation. And with that, we'll say thanks to our guest, Cecil Bridgewater. Again, he'll be in Champaign-Urbana as part of the Krannert Center Jazz Thread Series beginning the week after next. And you can certainly look at the Krannert Center website, and we'll be making sure to put stuff on our website if you'd like to get further information. And meanwhile, Cecil Bridgewater, thank you so much for spending the time with us.
It's been a pleasure.
All right. We'll see you soon.
All right.